Hello, everybody. This is Dane Gentry with the Standing Back Up podcast. Today, I'm here with my special guest, Mr. Scott DeLuzio. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing good, man. You know, I read your profile there, and I had another guy on that was an ex-military guy, retired from the military, and I like talking to you guys, man. I like trying to get y'all's voices out there. He has an internet radio station, different things like that, and as I read your story, you know, of course, my heart breaks. So, man, let's dive into it, man. Was you born in a military family?
No, actually. Well, in a way, sort of. So my grandfather served in World War II. He was in the Navy. He was in the Pacific, Iwo Jima and all that. You know, so he was over there. Apparently, going back in history, there were some people in my family that did serve in the military. Going way back. But it wasn't like it was, in our blood, like it was expected or anything. It's not like the family business, like a lot of folks, might kind of see. My parents, neither one of them were in the military. So it sort of skipped a generation. My brother and I both served, had cousin that served as well. It sort of, skipped a generation there. And when we joined, it was sort of a surprise to my family, because that was not the path that seemed like we would have ended up taking. If you were to sit there with a crystal ball when we were 5 years old and be like, okay, where are they going to end up? Military wasn't probably high up there on the list. We're a very patriotic family. We grew up not looking up to, Michael Jordan and, other, right. folks like that as like the superheroes. It was folks who put on a uniform and risked their lives every day, whether it was the police or firefighters or EMS or, military, any of those types of folks who go out there every day and are putting themselves in harm's way for other people. Those are the folks that we looked up to.
Yeah, that's an awesome way to look at it. So many people don't. And then, is my life, my ex-life, as a criminal will say, I never was one of them guys who was always like, oh man, the police are out to get me, a lot of people are. I wasn't one of them. I knew that anytime they were there for me, they had a reason to be there. And,
sure.
And especially today, in today's world, my hat goes off to them. they got so much to do with. We have my stepson's in the Marines now. I remember him saying, I remember he was, when he told me he was 15, I think he told his mom before that, but that he wanted to join. And just to be honest, my first thought was, I don't want you to do that. What I mean? But I'll say that he's a very good young man, man. And he's doing a thing. And So did you have any other thoughts? Like in high school, did you think, man, I want to go do this or that? Or was it about when did military come in?
Yeah, military, it was one of those things where I like the idea of serving more than the actual the service, right? In high school, probably a lot of people can probably relate to this. You had the recruiters coming in trying to get folks to sign up and all that kind of stuff. And that was just kind of what they did. And I wasn't totally interested in it at that point. I was planning on going to college, kind of had that route set in my mind. I was in college when 9/11 happened.
Okay.
And so I think I was a sophomore or so in college, when 9/11 happened. And I considered like that day or the day after, I forget exactly when, but like, pretty close to that day, I considered just saying, screw school. I'm dropping out and I'm joining the military because these guys came and attacked us. I want to in on this fight. And I decided to sleep on it, for a little bit, because I was like, I don't want to make an impulsive decision and then end up regretting it. So, so I slept on it and I said, all right, I already started school. I'm already partway through. I know if I drop out now, I'm not going back and I'm not going to get a degree. Might as well stick it out and finish it up, because whatever is going to happen as far as military response goes, it's probably still going to be there when I get done with school, and I can always join then. The military is not going anywhere. That's one thing. I think, you know, they say there's two things that are certain in life, you know, death and taxes.
Yeah.
You know, I think the military not going anywhere. I think that's pretty certain too.
We're not
rid of that anytime soon. So, yeah. I graduated college, and my younger brother actually decided to join the National Guard, shortly after, let's see, when was it? Yeah, it was like right around the time I was graduating, like shortly thereafter, maybe a few months after. And all of a sudden he went from being the little kid I used to, you know, kind of beat up in the backyard and horse around and all that kind of stuff, to now he was one of these guys that I looked up to, you know, that I was raised to like look up to. And I was like, holy crap, I'm so damn proud of him.
Right.
And I was looking at him in a whole new light. Right. And shortly after he joined, I think that like a couple months after, I heard a report in the news that was like something like the military was struggling to meet their recruiting numbers. And this is only just a few years. This was 2005 or something like that. 2005, I think it was, when I heard this, and they were struggling to meet their recruiting numbers. And I was like, this is only a few years after 9/11. Where were all those people who were ready to go kick some ass, you know, after 9/11? Where are all those people? And then I realized, crap, I was one of those people, and I still haven't done anything.
Right.
So I was like, okay, well, I told myself, graduate college, and if the war is still there, I'll join. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to follow the same path that my brother went, and I joined the National Guard as well. He happened to be going to school in Vermont at the time. So he joined the Vermont National Guard. We were living in Connecticut. So I joined the Connecticut National Guard. And so I kind of had a little idea of like what to expect going into basic training, all that kind of stuff, because he had just gone through it the year before. And so he was already in, he already kind of had a little feel for kind of what to expect. And I got in, and I was like, okay, I kind of know what to expect, but it's still, I don't care who you are. You get in there and, you know, drill sergeants are in your face and they're screaming and yelling and they're making you do all sorts of stuff. All that stuff just goes out the window because it's like, now you're in it. And it's like, they're throwing curveballs at you left and right, you know?
Right.
But that's kind of, you know, how I got in and how both of us got in.
Yeah. I remember when David went in, I remember the first day of the phone call deal. Might get the call, might not kind of deal. And they were screaming in the background. It was tough on my wife. I know that. And
I'm sure,
you know, it still is. Really, he's been in now 2 years.
Okay.
I guess 2 years. Yeah. He wanted to, when he had the idea of going to Japan, but I think they shot that down real quick. Right. He got in there. Now he's doing a mechanic thing or something, but I'm not really sure. How long was you in, man, before you had to go over?
This was about 4 years that I was in, before we deployed, four and a half years, somewhere around there, 4.5 to 5, somewhere like that. So we deployed to Afghanistan in 2010. And so I mentioned earlier, my brother was in the Vermont Army National Guard and I was in the Connecticut Army National Guard. Somewhere along the line, the Vermont and the Connecticut National Guard units that we were both in, there were some reorganizations that got done, and they came under the same brigade. And so this deployment to Afghanistan was a brigade wide deployment. So he and his unit and me and my unit, we all were deployed at the same time. And I heard somewhere, and I don't know how true this is, but I heard that it was the largest deployment of National Guard troops since World War II.
Wow.
That we were a part of at one time, you know, of the same unit, I should say. And so I think there were somewhere around 5,000 or so troops that were were deployed in this particular deployment. And so, so he was in a different location from where I was. It's not like we're on the same base or anything like that. Right. We were about 80 or 90 miles or so apart from each other. And so once we were over there, there was really no opportunity for us to see each other. The last time we actually saw each other was in training. We just happened to be in the same place at the same time for a little bit. And so we met up one night, actually the night that I was leaving that area to go someplace else. My unit missed our allotted time for chow, and me and a couple of our guys, we just snuck into the chow hall and we went to go eat. And it just happened to be the time that my brother was there, and sees me and he calls me over. And so it's kind of, I'm only mentioning this cause it's kind of a funny story. So, so we're all packed up and all of our stuff is on the trucks and everything. We're all, you know, getting ready to go. But I have kind of like a backpack, called it a salt pack. And I had that on. But I had a couple extra things, like, you know, comfort items, that type of stuff, pillows and that kind of stuff that just wouldn't fit in the bags that I put in there. So I had them like strapped on. And so my brother, he calls me over, and of course all his buddies are sitting around there, and I'm over there, and I sit down with him, and he's like, "What the? You look like a freaking hobo, man, with all this stuff hanging off your bag." And he's giving me so much crap, you know, as I'm sitting there, and I'm like, and if you knew him, like, that's just how he was. He would give you crap for just about anything. And you know, it's just his personality, but you know, it was all, you know, out of love and everything. So it was all good. But you know, it was kind of funny. But it was nice having that meal with him as well. Little did I know it'd be the you know, the last time we'd see each other, you know, before leaving for Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's tough, man. That, you know, that's the things that I know it's tough for you and your family, and these are the things that I think we really need to take at heart as American citizens in this country. You know, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I was talking to the guy's name is Donald Dunn, and he said, it's very uncomfortable when someone says, thank you for your service. He said, because we don't know how to react. And I never had thought about that. And that's another reason why I like doing these podcasts like this. So people understand, it's not that you guys don't want to hear it, but it's uncomfortable. I mean, because, and he said, and his reasoning was because he made it back, you know, and then in your case, I mean, it's your brother and your family. How long were y'all over there?
Yeah. So, let's see, I got there in, I think early February. He was there a couple weeks after me. So probably, you know, roughly the same time period, sometime in February, maybe he was early March, I forget. And he was killed in action at the end of August. So about 6 months, we were there. And, and then immediately after, he was killed in action, I was flown home. I think the next day I left Afghanistan. And as far as military transit goes, you know, leaving a country like Afghanistan and getting home, I was home in like 2 days, I think, after he was killed. That was like light speed. It was just so incredibly fast. So fast, in fact, that like, I don't know that I fully had time to kind of decompress and process everything and all that kind of stuff. And it was almost too fast. You know, it was great that I got home. Don't get me wrong, but, you know, you think about the troops coming back from like World War II, coming back from Europe or whatever, when they were coming back, they were on like transport ships and stuff. And they it took them, you know, a week or more to
get home. Long time.
And so like, they were around a bunch of folks that they knew, and they got to talk and kind of just decompress. I'm not at all comparing it and saying that they had it easier or anything like that.
Oh yeah.
I'm just saying, in a way, I sort of wish I had a little more time to
kind of understand that,
process things and decompress a bit. Cause that was a tough time. You know, that day, in addition to his death, there was other stuff too, that it was easily worst day of my life. You know, being, you know, between finding out that he was killed, about 15 minutes after I found out he was killed, I was in combat myself. There are folks shooting at us, and you know, there's small arms fire, RPGs, and things like that. And so now I'm dealing with the grief of losing my brother. Then I'm dealing with the anger of like,
yeah,
these people are now shooting at us. Like, I kind of want to just kill everybody, you know?
It. Yeah.
And you know, what do you do with all that? And how do you process all that? And I think I just like took everything and like just compartmentalized everything and just stuffed it down. And like, I'll deal with that stuff later. Right now, yeah, I got to deal with this. So I make it out alive so that my parents don't get a second knock on the door. So that my newborn son who is at home with my wife, so that they don't get a knock on the door, you know, and he ends up being fatherless. My wife, you know, without a husband and all that. And I didn't want any of that to happen. So I was like, okay, I got to put the stuff I can't control. I just got to shove that down. My brother's dead. I can't control that. And so I got to stuff that down and just put it out of my mind for now, as hard as that might be. And I gotta go lead my troops, and I gotta go do what I need to do to make sure we all make it out.
Were you married when you went in?
Not when I joined the army. Okay. But when so I got married about 2 years later, and then our son was born about a year after that. And yeah, so things moved kind of quickly in that time period. There was a lot of change.
Like when you and your wife got married, did y'all ever sit around and talk about, hey, you know, I'm probably going to have to go over there? Or were you thinking?
Well, I think it was kind of just a mutual understanding. She knew my brother had deployed to Iraq previously. He actually was in Iraq while I was in basic training.
Okay.
So it was not unknown that the National Guard gets deployed. We knew that, we did talk about things like that. Like, you know, what happens if, the worst happens, what happens if I do have to go overseas, but during the time that I was getting deployed, it was a very, there's a lot of events going on all at the same time. You know, my son was born a couple months before I was deployed. So my wife and I both became first time parents at that point.
Right.
So that's a pretty huge deal.
Yeah.
My wife, about a month or so before giving birth to my son, she got sick, and she was in the hospital for a little bit. And, that was obviously concerning because, you know, you don't never know with the baby and all that kind of stuff, like what could go on. And then add on deploying to all that. It's like just a lot of stuff going on. And so some of the stuff, I think we just kind of had an understanding. I don't think we actually had a sit down conversation about all this stuff. We just kind of just had a mutual understanding of all this. Now there were some events that the National Guard put on to help family members kind of know what to expect as far as, what happens when we are deployed and all that kind of stuff. So there was already some baseline level knowledge that we kind of just expected that each other had, because we went through all of this stuff together. So, so those conversations maybe didn't necessarily need to be had, but, we did talk a little bit about it, but not in any excruciating detail.
So after that happened to your brother, did you ever go back, or is there something that says like when your family member, if your brother, do you have to go back?
So there's actually nothing that says that you can't go back. Okay. Or that, after my brother was killed and I was sent out of Afghanistan, I actually was on the same flight that he was on, that transported his body out. I've sort of felt fortunate that I was able to escort his body out of Afghanistan. But when we got to Kuwait, we had to part ways, and I continued on my journey, and they have a mortuary affairs kind of thing that where they did some stuff with him. And I don't know the specific details, but it was nothing for me to stick around for.
Right.
So I went my separate way. I'm drawing blanks. I'm sorry. The question.
Oh, you're fine. Yeah, I can only imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. So when we got back, like I said, it was pretty quick getting back, but, I'm sorry, your question again,
going back, do you have to go back in?
Oh, like, yeah. I'm sorry.
You came home. You're fine. Yes.
My mind went off on one track and then all right, on another. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of people get in their mind from like Saving Private Ryan, where they're out searching for like the last surviving brother, and we need to bring him home. Well, there's nothing that's Hollywood, for you.
I figured,
there's nothing that says that you have to get that person out and all that. They did send me home, for the funeral, and I was only given, I think it was 10 days or 2 weeks or something like that, that I was supposed to be home. But when I was home at my brother's funeral, the governor of the state of Connecticut was at the funeral, and she came to our family after the funeral and just kind of offered her condolences and that type of thing. And for a lot of folks don't know this, but the National Guard is kind of special in the military in that, the president is a commander in chief over the entire military, the active duty reserves, and including the National Guard when they're on active status, overseas, like we were. But the governor of the state of wherever you happen to be from is the commander in chief over that state's National Guard.
Okay.
And so the governor said that she's going to order that I stay home. And that, that I don't go back overseas. So, it was kind of a unique situation there. And in a way it was good and bad, the way that it happened. So it was good because obviously I got to be home. I was with my family. That was good for me for, healing purposes. It was good for them because they weren't worried about me being overseas and all that. But for me, I was also worried about the guys that I left behind, the soldiers that were still there. About a month after my brother's funeral, the base that we were stationed at was on CNN because of some stuff going on in that area. And I'm looking at it like, crap, I should be there.
Right.
What if something happened and something happened to one of those guys? Like, I felt the need to be there. And that was, I think, one of the first times that I really understood why my brother was in Afghanistan in the first place. Because I said before, he was deployed to Iraq.
Right.
And his enlistment would have been up at some point during our deployment to Afghanistan. So they weren't going to send him just for, partway through and then have to send him back home if he didn't re-enlist. So he re-enlisted so that he could be with the guys that he had served with before. Okay. And I kind of understand it now. Like at first I was like, what the hell is wrong with you, man? Like you did your job. You did what you signed up for. You can be free and clear of this and you don't have to, you don't have to worry about this anymore. And I get it now, after seeing the video on CNN of my, the base that I was at and being like, I know exactly where that is. Like I've walked there before. Yeah. I know where that is. And then saying, well, the guys that I'm serving with, like they're kind of in danger right now and this isn't good. My heart was broken. It's like, I want to be there, but I need to be here. What do I do? But, there's nothing that says I had to, get out. It was just the governor's orders. After a few months after being home, I realized the military was not going to be in my future, long-term. And I was near the end of my enlistment anyways. By the time I kind of came to this conclusion, there's only a few months left in my enlistment. And I put in for a what's called surviving sons and daughters. And it's basically a way to separate early from the military that doesn't affect your discharge status. It's still an honorable discharge. It's doesn't affect anything like that. It just basically says, hey, your family has sacrificed enough.
Right.
You know, you're able to leave there. So that's, I think, loosely what the movie Saving Private Ryan was based off of. It just isn't written the way that Hollywood wrote it. It took some liberties with how all that worked, but yeah, I put in for that, and that's how I ended up getting out of the military. You know, at that point.
So how did the, so when did you start thinking about writing the book?
I actually started writing it and not intending to write a book, but I actually started the initial forms of it really early on after I got back from Afghanistan. It was really just notes, things I didn't want to forget, like places I was at and people that were there and the way I was feeling about certain things. Because I knew at some point my son, and then eventually I had a couple other kids as well. But I knew eventually there was going to be questions about, you know, what did you do when you're in the army? What did you do overseas? What happened to our uncle? You know, that type of thing. And I don't want to forget any of that stuff. So I just started writing down notes, that I wrote down and sort of forgot about for years. And then a few years ago, I kind of uncovered those notes and, I said, you know, this should be more than just notes sitting around collecting dust. It should be more of a story that will outlive me. Obviously, it'll outlive my brother, but it'll give folks in the future hopefully a glimpse into, you know, the lives of a couple soldiers who fought in Afghanistan. Just, you know, one piece of history, you know, kind of like what we're doing here is just, you know, telling this story to folks who might be interested in learning a little bit more about what happens to people when they're deployed and what happens when somebody doesn't come home. You know, when they are killed in action. And so the book goes into all of that. It talks a lot about our you know, background or childhood and stuff like that. Not in excruciating detail, but in, you know, enough detail. So you get to start to paint the picture of who we were,
right,
you know, back then and why we did the things that we did. And then, you know, talks about our time overseas and then talks about when we come home and what happens. It's not what you, it's not something you ever think about. You always think that these types of things happen to other people. You watch the news and, you know, you might see a story about, you know, a family that something like this happened to, and, you know, your heart breaks for them for a little bit, but 10, 15 minutes later, you sort of forget about it. Because it's other people. And I kind of was the same way. I was that I think it's sort of human nature. That, you don't want to dwell on the negative things like that, but it is reality. And I think it's important to know about because we're sending people overseas, you know, back at the height of the war, there are tens of thousands of people overseas and they were fighting, they were dying. They were coming home in flag draped caskets. And those are real families that have to now pick up the pieces and deal with all of that. And I think it's important for us as a society to know about this stuff because let's face it, America is not, you know, shy of going to war. So there's going to be another war at some point coming up, you know,
probably soon.
Yeah. You know, if it's not in the next, you know, year, it'll be coming up, you know, at some point that there's enough appetite, I think, for war that they're going to send people. And, you know, we have to just realize that these are real people and real families with real people who care about them. And, you know, I'm not anti-war by any stretch of the imagination. I'm all for it if it makes sense.
Right.
And, you know, send folks in to go and do the job. We got a lot of great men and women who are ready, willing, and able to lay their lives down for the right cause. But if you're going out there and you're sending people for a cause that doesn't mean anything, you know, is that really something that we need to be doing? And that's sort of what I want to get through to people is let's use this story as kind of just a little piece of information to keep in the back of your head. Is like, that's going to be a real family at some point with real bodies coming home. And, and do we really want that? Is it worth it for whatever this cause is? And in some cases, the answer may be yes. Some cases, the answer is going to be no, but we just got to kind of play that in to the whole equation.
Yeah, I agree. You know, again, it goes back to what I said a while ago. Helping people just truly understand, man, you know, and not even just when we lose someone, just what you guys deal with just on a daily basis. Some, you know, some guys deal with a lot, man, you know, some are, you know, the suicide rate is through the roof, and it's sad, and there should just be more done, man. And that was kind of my thing with David, was kind of like, because at that time is everything was in the news real big about what being done for the soldiers and all this. And I was just like, I don't want you going over doing that, man, and then coming back and you know, the country doing the wrong thing.
Right. You know, and a lot has changed just even in the attitudes about mental health and helping the soldiers, just even in the last, since I got back from Afghanistan, this was, you know, 2010 time period, you know, so we're talking almost 14 years now that I've been home from there. And, you know, a lot has changed with all of that, because we just started talking about it more, I think. I think we did that conversation has just been there. Back, I remember when I first got home, I was thinking to myself, I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to go talk to a therapist or a shrink or anything. Like, keep those people away from me. I don't want to be around any of that. And so when I would go to like the mandatory mental health screenings, which they had, which at the time I kind of felt like they were sort of a joke. They weren't taking all that serious. I mean, the providers took them seriously, but the soldiers weren't taking them seriously.
Right.
And, you know, I felt like I just went in and lied through my teeth just to check the boxes and get through those mandatory sessions. No, I wasn't doing okay. Yes, I needed help. No, I didn't want it. I figured I can get through this myself. I was a soldier. I was like, I'm strong. I should be able to do this. I'm the one that other people call when they need help with stuff. They call me. So why am I going to go, you know, get help from somebody else? But what I didn't realize was there's some stuff I did need help with, and I couldn't handle on my own, and I needed to do something about it.
Yeah, that's the same thing. It's by no means not the same, but you take somebody like myself, you know, I went to prison for all that time. And throughout that time, I was in solitary confinement for 9 years, you know, and that's a long time. And I didn't want to deal with it. And I thought I was fine, no problems. And, you know, when I'm sitting there and I can't even go into a MAPCO to get something to drink, something's wrong. You know, there's a problem there. And I didn't deal with it for a long time.
Yeah,
I put a Band-Aid on it with drugs. And when I got sober, I was rocking along, thought everything was fine, and went to sleep one night, woke up next morning, I was a different man. The bottom fell out. And I had to go and talk to somebody, just as you said. And it kind of relates the same as I used to think of it as being weak. You know, man, there's nothing weak about it. It makes you stronger to go and get help and talk about it. And that's what we need.
And I kind of look to that point that you just made there, which is great. I think it's spot on, because again, I was a soldier. I was supposed to be the strong one, and you know, the opposite of strong is weak. And so if I'm not strong, then I must be weak is kind of the mindset that I had. But you think about somebody who goes to the gym and they lift weights. They're not going because they're weak. They're going to get stronger. You don't look at someone who walks into the gym. It's like, oh, look at that weak guy walking in, you know, muscles bulging out of his shirt and all that kind of stuff. Like, look at that weak guy walking in there. Like, no, he's strong, but he's not going to stay strong if he doesn't go and do something to work on himself and improve himself. And same thing with me, like or anybody, you're not going to stay strong if you're not out there doing the work to improve yourself, whether it's physical or mental. And you gotta put the work in in order to stay that way.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, had when it all first started with me, the first question they would ask was I suicidal? And I'd say no, you know, but I would also say, but if I ever get there, we have a problem. Because I knew me, you know, and I was just like, and then we got there and I started taking it a little bit more serious. And thank God I'm okay today. All right. Tell us the name of your book, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So the book is called Surviving Son. And it's about, again, it's about the deployment to Afghanistan, where I lost my brother. Goes into our background a little bit. You get to kind of know us a little bit better by going through that kind of background. But also it gives you an insight into what happens after coming back home. So yeah, the book Surviving Son, you can get on Amazon in any format that you like it. So there's audiobook, there's the ebook, there's the hardcover paperback versions available. So Surviving Son on Amazon.
And you have a podcast yourself too, right?
I do. Yes. The podcast is called Drive On Podcast. And we talk about a lot of the issues that we are talking about here today. Any issues that affect the military community. Started off really just helping veterans with PTSD and, you know, trying to help combat the suicide rates. But I started realizing that the suicide issue that we're dealing with in the military community is bigger than just PTSD. Obviously that has a component there, but there's a lot of things that happen with folks that, you know, it could be relationships, it could be finances, it could be, a whole number of different things that folks are going through, and we need to help them with everything that they may be going through so that they don't go down that path that you were just describing and get to that point where they feel like that's their only option. That's not the way to go. You know, you're not a burden on folks. People want you to be happy and healthy and, you know, get back on your feet, and they want to see you succeed. And so what we do is we share stories from other folks who've been in your shoes, who've been in bad situations. They found their way out. They found their way to a better life, a better, happy, healthy, you know, type of life. And we also talk to providers of services that are available to veterans and their families and the folks that care for them. And so that way you can find the resources that you need and you can learn a little bit about those resources. A lot of times people think about the VA. And they're like, okay, that's where I'm going to go if I need help. And that's great. They have a ton of services, a ton of support. It's just a matter of figuring out where it is that you need to go and asking the right questions sometimes. But they're also limited. They only have so much available. And there may be, you maybe tried a lot of the stuff that they have to offer and none of it's working for you. There's other stuff out there that is not affiliated with the VA at all. And there's nonprofits and other organizations. So we talk about all those. Really, the goal is to give hope to folks who may feel like they have no hope. And you know, whether it comes from me or it comes from you or anybody else, just knowing that there's someone out there who wants to help you is hopefully going to be helpful to some folks.
Yeah, and that's the whole, you know, I deal with mostly addiction and stuff, but it's the same thing, premise. That's what we do it for. I want people to understand there is a better life. You know,
right.
People that knew me in my past probably never would have believed, you know what I mean? That I'm sitting here doing the things I do today, but that's what I want people to understand is that you can do it too. You know, with us as addicts, you know, the first place you got to start is God, but you have to stop saying you can't, man. Stop and start saying you can. Because you can, you know, I don't know one drug addict that can't get sober or clean, whatever word you want to use, because you can, man, you know, and I kind of get, not mad, but aggravated when I hear the word can't a lot, you know. Listen, I was as bad as you could be, you know what I mean? We could go into all that, be a whole nother podcast, but it's, you know, you can come out of it, man, and your life can turn around, and you may not get everything back as far as relationships and stuff, but that's okay. Just live a good life. We got enough bad in this world today. You know, we don't need to add to it. And people are dying. Two people this week I know have died. So it's a bad thing. Do you know a guy by the name of Donald Dunn?
I do, actually. Okay. Yeah, I've had him on my show, and I've been on his show as well. You mentioned him earlier about thank you for your service comment. And
yeah,
I agree with what he said. It's not that we don't appreciate it. You know, we definitely appreciate it. And I'm not saying anything about that. And I think his comments probably as well, he probably would agree with me. Not to put words in his mouth or anything. I don't want to discourage anybody from thanking veterans or service members for their service. Please keep doing it. We definitely appreciate it. Where it gets uncomfortable is what's the response? Like if I hold the door for you and you say thank you, I'll say you're welcome. That's just a natural flow of a conversation. But if you thank me for my service or any other service member for their service, I want to thank you for thanking me. So my initial reaction is I want to say thank you, but it's like thank you. Like were you going to just keep going back and forth like this? Because this could never end at some point. But I also want to say you're welcome, because it's I did this thing. It's it was a good thing, but you're appreciative of it, and you're welcome for whatever it is that you're appreciated for. But also, it's just doing a job, to a lot of folks. I don't think the grocery store clerk who's putting the cans on the shelves or anything. I mean, not to say I couldn't, but it's like oftentimes they're not there as I'm walking down the aisle and taking the cans off the shelf. So it's, but even if I did, he'd be like, oh, I'm just doing a job. It's like not a big deal. Like I'm getting the thanks is I got paid for it, and that's that. And so in a way, it's sort of that same kind of mentality that I think some folks have when you thank them for their service, and that might be part of it. So it's like just a confusing dynamic with people. Like how am I supposed to respond? It's like I just don't know what to do with this information right now.
I get that, it.
So hopefully that clarifies it. It's definitely not to discourage anyone from doing it. It's just we sometimes kind of laugh and joke about it or amongst ourselves, because we all kind of have that kind of awkward feeling sometimes where we just kind of don't know how to respond.
Yeah, he pretty much said the same thing. It's pretty much spot on. All right, man. One last question. Tell us how your life is today, man.
Life has its up and downs. I think no matter what stage in life you're in, there's going to be ups and downs. I think the goal is to have more ups and downs. Try to balance it out, but try to see the good things in life. And that's where I'm trying to work towards. To be honest, I still go to therapy. I still talk to someone on a weekly basis, and I'm still going through some stuff that I'm working through. And some days are okay. Some days I don't even want to get out of bed. I force myself to do it. And the way I do it is actually something I heard on the Jocko podcast. If anyone who's listening is familiar with that, great podcast. But he said, if there's ever a time when you're feeling like you don't want to do that thing, get out of bed, go work out, go do whatever that thing is that you don't want to do, force yourself, just go do it today and tell yourself, if I'm still feeling this way tomorrow, I could take a day off. I could take a break. I can give myself a rest. And let me tell you, like 99 times out of 100, the next day I'm fine. And I'm good to go. You know what I mean? So just force yourself to do it today, get through today, and tell yourself you can do it tomorrow. You can take that day off tomorrow. If you really need it, you can take it. Actually, just this past week, I took a day off because I was just not feeling it. I was tired. No. I was run down. I felt like I just needed a day of rest. And so I took it. And I can't remember the last time I did it before that, though. So it's rare, you know. So, you know, give yourself that kind of little motivation, force yourself, push yourself. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. Kind of just, you know, pushing through, driving through the tough times, but you know, enjoying the good times as well.
Awesome, man. That's what we love to hear. I get my shows out pretty quick, man. It'll be out later tonight. Actually, it may be tomorrow. I forgot I got something I'm doing this evening, but either way, it'll be out by Monday. I like to do that. I don't do a lot of editing. Kind of what's done is done. It's kind of how I started it out, man. I want to thank you for your time, man.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to come on and share my story with you and your listeners, and I appreciate everything that you're doing.
Yes, sir, man, and look forward to it. I'll see you again. You write another book or anything like that, shoot me an email, man.
Will do. Will do. Thank you.
God bless, man. See you.
Yeah, same to you.